U.S. President Joe Biden has threatened to impose new sanctions on Myanmar after the military detained the civilian leaders of its government. He said the U.S. had removed sanctions on Myanmar, referred to in the statement as Burma, over the past decade after its transition to democracy. But Washington will not hesitate to restore those measures if that transition is reversed.
At a time when China has weaponized rare earth supplies, U.S. President Donald Trump has set his eyes on Myanmar's rare earth reserves, opening up a new front against China.
You're listening to a special series from the Inside Myanmar podcast, where we're examining a quiet but deeply consequential move. The United States Treasury's Office of Foreign Asset Control, or OFAC, recently removed several Myanmar military-linked individuals and entities from its sanction list. These delistings have sparked urgent questions about accountability, the direction of U.S. foreign policy, and what message this sends both the military junta and democratic resistance. Regional arms trafficking, illicit finance, and rare earth mineral extractions are all on the rise with consequences that stretch far beyond Myanmar's borders. In this series, we're speaking with lawmakers, legal experts, human rights advocates, and voices from Myanmar's frontline struggle to unpack what happened, why it matters, and what comes next with that. Let's listen to the episode that follows.
Mitchell, thank you for joining us today at Insight Myanmar Podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Joining us today is someone who's been at the heart of U.S. policy on Myanmar for decades. Derek Mitchell served as the first American ambassador to the country since 1990, holding that post from 2012 to 2016, and has played a central role in shaping how Washington responds to Myanmar's political and strategic challenges. If you'd like more background on those critical years, I invite listeners to check out our earlier conversation that covered that range in episode 317. Derek Mitchell has also had senior roles at the State Department, Pentagon, and National Democratic Institute, where he led global democracy programs. His regional expertise, especially his early warnings about China's expanding influence, have made him a key voice in policy discussions, to the extent that in 2020, China personally sanctioned him for his support of democracy in Hong Kong and his leadership at NDI. This was one of several U.S. organizations accused of interfering in China's internal affairs. But the focus of today's conversation is on U.S. sanctions policy towards Myanmar, especially the recent delistings and what they may signal. From there, we're going to be exploring the broader direction of U.S. strategy in the region, the role of rare earths and economic leverage, and what meaningful engagement might look like for Myanmar's future. So to start this out, I think the first question I would like to ask you is these recent delistings, they have stirred confusion and concern among many. From your perspective, are these decisions strategic, transactional, or simply a sign of potential drift in U.S. policy?
It's hard to unpack because, you know, the Trump administration has a lot of different strands going at any given time. My suspicion, and they have been very adamant about this in public, of saying this is not a signal of a change in policy. They have been talking to journalists and said privately they are reviewing the policy. I've even talked to them about that very early on this year. But they are saying that is not connected, that this may just be simply something, as they explain it, something that started during the previous administration, a process to the Treasury Department. And it could be the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. So every indication and every word coming out of the administration from the start has been that it is not connected to a broader policy change, though there is a policy review underway.
So do you think there's any strategic logic in your view to the idea of engaging certain actors within or around the junta as a way to peel Myanmar away from China's grip? And also to ask, do you think that this idea has any currency in Washington? Is this anything you've heard? And if so, is this in America's interests?
I don't think it has necessarily currency. I think it's being considered by this administration. I think the president himself, from what I understand, was made aware that Myanmar has rare earths. And this is a strategic issue for the United States. We've been looking everywhere to find how do we get access so we're not so reliant on China, even though China, regardless of where you mine it, they're the ones who process it. So they still have 90% of the processing of rare earths globally, and we still are relying on them. But there is a strategic desire to find where can we get access aside from having to rely on China, and Burma and Myanmar came to the attention of the president, who then directed his people to look into this, and they have been looking into it. I don't think, though, that any decision had been made. I think there's been evidence that as they look into the issue, they realize just how complicated the issue is, how complicated the situation inside Myanmar is, the conflict situation, the geographic situation of where the rare earths are located. So I think they've been instructed to find out and report back. But my sense is they're finding out, reporting back, that it is quite complicated. And I don't get a sense there's been any decision. But the conversations continue. I don't think a final decision has been made either way. So it's hard to judge where it's going. I should just add another point to all of this. When asked, you know, is this part of a broader change in policy? You know, what's happening in the Trump administration generally is, you know, for instance, people may have heard that there's been an evisceration of the National Security Council because of a MAGA advisor to the president who had it out for certain leaders, including the National Security Advisor himself and his deputy, who were purged, basically, based on the word of this single influencer. That because the National Security Council has been eviscerated, there really isn't a great process for considering in an interagency and considered way, in a systematic way, policies like this. So I know that early on there was a Burma policy review, Myanmar policy review, that was sidelined because of this evisceration of the National Security Council. And it also tells me there's likely not a really systematic process, and it's more likely there are individual strands doing what individual strands do when issues are raised to them and things are within their purview. I don't have confirmation of that, but again, that fits what the administration itself is saying and some other indicators, you know, from administration policies on Myanmar, which we can get to. You asked me whether I believe it is good policy to consider rare earths and find a policy around the current one in order for us to get access. I'm basically where the administration seems to be falling. We'll see where it heads, but it is an extraordinarily complicated situation politically. I think they probably learned that these rare earths are not in places where the junta have control. If they want to change their policy towards the junta, that's not going to help them get access. I think the idea that we would broker, for instance, a peace agreement between the junta and the KIA, the Kachin, is beyond strange. It's quite very unlikely. But I do think it is worthwhile, and I think Sean Turnell's made this point, regardless of the rare earths, but even connected to that, to have a better relationship with the KIA, the United States, and to engage with some in the opposition, so-called, democratic opposition, or those in the resistance, as it were. So that, I think, makes sense, of engaging more directly with some of the forces that are creating facts on the ground and have control of their territories beyond junta control. But the idea of changing our policy to work through the junta is, I think, a fool's errand, and something I imagine that the administration has figured out, but it's very difficult sometimes to predict where this administration goes.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're suggesting the idea of the American administration looking to work with the Kachin or other ethnic groups, this, of course, would fall in line more with the kind of work that could be done with supporting civil society, supporting the buildup of democracy, supporting a resistance to an illegal military takeover of an election where no evidence was provided for fraud as a justification for that. These seem to me all as values and background that this administration has, in the U.S. has already somewhat moved away from. And so, this might be a more traditional way of engagement at this time, although even in the past, there's been hesitancy towards engaging with some of these ethnic groups, but the context has changed somewhat today. However, this is an administration that has put out, and the president himself has put out some statements that have, many of which have been beyond strange, and some of them have been enacted to some degree, and some of them have not. And so, looking at this direction of what I might call the unthinkable, given the U.S.'s long-standing support of the Burmese democracy movement, do you have any concerns or hesitations that a beyond strange scenario of some form of seeing that of looking at the regime as the kind of strong actor in the country that can also be a wedge with China? Do you have any deep concern harbored in the back of your mind that this could one day be a scenario that we're looking at?
You never know. And what I was saying was beyond strange or a fool's errand, I think it was specifically about brokering a peace agreement between the junta and the KIA and getting in the middle and thinking we could do that. Now, would they, given that Trump likes to think of himself as, a Nobel Peace Prize type who's seeking to create peace around the world, and he takes credit for anything that he gets involved with, if it leads to a ceasefire or such, potentially. But I don't see that this issue is really on the radar of the administration to that degree. And I think it would be extraordinarily difficult to get both sides to a resolution through U.S. mediation. Now, China will have something to say about that. And if the U.S. were to be involved, it would create all kinds of challenges, complications for those actors, because the Chinese then would get obviously directly engaged and make it difficult potentially for some of the actors to be influenced by the United States. It would complicate matters to some degree. So we just have to understand how complicated that situation is. Again, I don't believe it's wrong to be engaged with the ethnics, certainly from the resistance, the opposition side. And it is possible, certainly, that the administration could engage with the junta in some fashion. I don't think that is outside the realm of possibility. I don't think they believe in sanctions generally. They've made it clear they don't care so much about whether elections are fair or not. They just care about whether what happens in the country is in the interest of the United States directly through whether it's trade or yes, China being a factor. So I don't think it's beyond consideration by this administration of figuring out some way where they can gain an advantage geopolitically. But I don't think any decision has been made. I do think they're looking at it. They have to think about it carefully. I think there are great dangers in trying to do it, just going in with one foot. Certainly not going to help Myanmar very much to do it haphazardly. But we'll just have to see. I can't predict where they end up.
Sure. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Going back to what we began the conversation with, the nature of these delistings, I wonder if you can give us some background from your time as ambassador and just from your extensive experience in the State Department and your other positions, the nature of what it of how it looks like for someone to find themselves being considered for and then put on the SDN list and the process of getting off.
It's typically a very cumbersome process on both ends. It's probably easier to get on than it typically is to come off, which has been a problem somewhat on sanctions. It's been a criticism of sanctions that it's easy to put them on and very difficult to take them off, which makes them less agile as a policy instrument. So it does take a lot for Treasury. If there's a considered process, and this was simply a process on the merits, how four folks who were involved in arms trafficking came off. Maybe it's because I think one of them, I don't know them in depth. I don't know the situation of all four. I know one of them is part of a family and may have a peripheral kind of connection. And maybe they were convinced by lobbyists here that that person, that one specific person should not be listed, even if other family members were, because they were directly involved. But there's been no explanation, and that's been unfortunate. There should be an explanation as to why folks come off the list. There are explanations as to why they go on. They explain the things they've done and why they deserve to be designated. When they come off, or when these four came off, when asked the question, they said no comment. They wouldn't give any information. And when you leave a vacuum of information, then others are going to fill that with speculation, which is what happened. People were speculating that it meant the administration was going to change their policy, was connected to rare earths or connected to something, which the administration then shot down, called it fake news. But, you know, when you leave a vacuum of information, that's what happens. So there needs to be an explanation. And I can't explain how these four in particular were able to come off the list. Given how typically onerous it is to make a case that these four came on for a reason, then what is the reason? What did they do that makes them somehow now innocent?
And yet there is this real battleground shaping up in terms of the information space between the resistance and the military, with the military clearly claiming, you know, the correspondence between Minh-Anh Lang and Trump, if you want to even call it that, with the tariff letter and then the back and forth letters that happened there and the request to have sanctions removed and this being the result and the potential SAC delegation that's trying to go and to DC as well to have meetings, that the military is claiming all of these things, are building these into a narrative that's showing a changing of the tide, whereas we're hearing more from the resistance side that, well, these things are, you know, symbolically they might hold some sway, but when taken together, they're really just disparate things, and there's no real change. And pointing to the recent legislation that's giving more support towards Burma, as you say, the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing. And so there is this information war shaping up in terms of what exactly does this mean? What is it that did happen?
Yeah, I mean, just note a couple other items, a couple other data points aside from the public statements that there's nothing to see here, no change in policy, fake news, all that kind of thing. And fake news is what they use for anything. So you cannot necessarily, take that to the bank. But this past week, Sean O'Neill, who's been leading up the State Department Asia policy, kind of until we have an assistant secretary, he's designated to be ambassador to Thailand. And during his hearing this past week, he said that, you know, the election at the end of the year would be a sham. And it should not be, we should not legitimize the junta. And he said if he were ambassador to Thailand, he would press Thailand not to legitimize the junta. So this is someone who's close to MAGA, so he's going out there saying the right things about the election, denigrating the junta. Now, what you say in your hearing, what you do in the job, we've seen that in this administration as well. You get through any way you can. And then once you're in your position, you could always change. We've seen that. Of course, but this was a pretty much full-throated, denigration of the election, at least, and of the junta, of its legitimacy, by someone who could have deflected. and didn't. So that was an encouraging sign. And then just now, I mean, the 40% tariff is still in place. It's now, you know, as of August 1st, that is until there is a negotiation, that tariff has been put in place. And that's a big deal. So, you know, there's no kind of corners being cut. And the signals are good. And of course, you're getting pressure from Congress. They're passing laws or legislation as well that is encouraging. So right now, I think we just have to keep our powder dry. I have to watch very closely. I think ensure that the administration has all the information it needs to understand that trying to play strategic games here has so many different angles that they ought to be extremely careful to get in the middle of that.
You mentioned the incoming ambassador to Thailand, referencing the sham elections. You know, it's especially concerning given the statement that went out to the State Department for those in embassies not to comment on the legitimacy of elections. And so to, in some ways that goes even more out of the way in referencing that, that they will not recognize these elections. So that is a good sign.
Hope that stands, and we'll see. You know, he's trying to be ambassador to Thailand. He's not going to be the decider in the administration. But I do know that there are people in senior levels of state, whether they are the ultimate decider on this type of thing, determinant on it, who have the right feeling about Myanmar, and say in meetings to people, let's not forget about Myanmar. And they're in senior positions. Ultimately, it comes down to one person. If the president, for some reason, if it gets on his radar, and the idea is probably it shouldn't be on his radar. It's only on his radar, I think, because of rare earths. But if they go back to him and say, look, there's nothing to see here, too complicated. You don't want to be involved in the conflict there. We have enough problems. You know, this is not something that's, high on his list of wanting to be involved in, or high on MAGA's list to be anywhere engaged on. So the hope is that inertia will continue the current program, current policy.
Yeah, right. And then looking at the type of engagement that could be happening in Myanmar, and you mentioned how, you know, there are people that are in state and senior positions that are that really do have a proper understanding of the situation that's going on in Myanmar. And that makes me wonder about the different ways that it could be framed. And when you were there, did you find traction? And I would also wonder if this traction continues to today, because we're in a very different context, and framing U.S. engagement, not just in moral or democratic terms, but also as part of broader competition with China, if that kind of framing helped move policy back then, and to what degree that, you know, Myanmar was also kind of intentionally framed as somewhat of a wedge issue and somewhat of a way to blunt a bit of China's aggression, or to what degree back then it was focused more on the moral and democratic ways of engagement than what we're seeing now with it.
Yeah, we may have talked about this the last time when we did this, but I imagine there might have been during my day differing views on the motivations. I mean, I myself never made this about China. I felt like if we were interested in having Myanmar, come out of its isolation and democratize, open up, as it were, then we needed to engage on its own terms. And we couldn't make it a function of a third country. We didn't want to suggest there was a tool somehow, some great power competition. Though, to be very honest, there were some within the country that were very glad to have us be part of something like that. And I suspect that, you know, there are others in the Obama administration that saw this as certainly a way to bring another country into a fold that is more akin to American values and the American side than the Chinese, because even then there was competition. So yes, it was part of the consideration. It wasn't certainly wasn't my focus as I engaged and did my work. And I do think these days it's much more central. If you, in an administration and during a time where the competition with China is really out in the open, the Chinese have made it out in the open, and I think the United States has joined that. We've decided not to kind of put that in the shadows anymore. And talk about that kind of thing, that the Chinese have a different view of itself and of its place in the region that's not consistent with not just U.S. interests, but frankly, regional interests They all want to have sovereignty. They want to have their own independent, way forward. So that today, yes, I think it gets some attention because of the China factor. And I worry a little bit if they're not smart about this, if they think, oh, here's a way that we can use Myanmar as a wedge, as a Western, for instance, as a Western front. You know, China's focused east. We're concerned about Taiwan, South China Sea. This is kind of like the 1950s all over again. We can have activity along the border and to distract the Chinese westward. And therefore, we basically fight to the last Burmese. It didn't help in the 50s. It was not good for the country when we were doing that with the Kuomintang and through the CIA and that kind of thing in those days, you know. And I don't think it would be smart. And I also don't think it would be at all good for Myanmar, only destructive if we were doing something like that and not thinking through very carefully the consequences for the country itself. But I can't dismiss whether there are any people. I don't know of any people thinking like that. I don't know if people know that history. But if anyone does decide to think in those terms, I think we would have to really, you know, I would want to go through with them what the implications of those for U.S. interests. Those of us who care about Myanmar, clearly, you know, that matters. But for these guys, it's not going to be a matter of necessarily anyone else's interests. It's only going to be American interests directly that will have to be discussed. And we're going to have to make that case.
It is so dicey because when you talk about the... how getting involved in that region could set some things off in how delicate the situation is. That's certainly true. And yet what is, you know, there's so many different kinds of engagement and what kind of engagement could one execute carefully there? And, you know, cause I'm saying this thinking that Beijing has made clear that, much of Myanmar and certainly northern Myanmar is really their sphere of influence. I mean, even so much as I remember hearing that even when American ambassadors would want to visit Kachin State, in their posting, China expressed a bit of dissatisfaction that was more kind of closer to where they were based, and the Americans should just leave it alone, which was absurd. Yeah. And so, you know, and just before we were talking about the potential of engaging the American administration, engaging the Kachin, the KIA, and kind of the positive implications of what that could bring. And yet any level of engagement, any level of presence or talks, even that alone sounds like it could start to, you know, to say nothing of covert CIA operations that happened in 1950 or supporting one actor or the other close to the Chinese border, you know, but merely just going and talking and having a conversation, that itself could be triggering. So there's a lot there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was that first ambassador who they told, don't go to Kachin State, don't go to Shan State. You must respect our interests. That's what the ambassador, the Chinese ambassador, told me as I was leaving the last several months. There's a new ambassador came in. He was absolutely blunt. I was stunned that he did that. And to be very frank, I may have mentioned this the last time. The last trip I took as ambassador was to Kachin State. I was going anyway. But when he said, don't go, it was almost I had to go to demonstrate that it is not for them to tell Myanmar, who it has relations with, or Kachin people, with whom we allied, by the way, to defend them in World War II. Chinese always like to look back to the days when we were partners during World War II and Japan was the enemy. And I actually told the ambassador at the time, you know, the reason why we have this special relationship with the Kachin was defending you in World War II that you always celebrate so much. So we have a special relationship with the Kachin. And I think we ought to continue to have that relationship, a special relationship with the Kachin from history. I think the Kachin want that. I think the idea of, and I'll just be very frank on this because I have been a little bit careful here because I don't want to give anybody any ideas. I don't know if the administration is even thinking this, but, you know, if they get involved in, you know, you give weapons to folks there because this will distract China and we can play games with, you know, we can... That gets very, 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 and I can't even say I understand entirely what would result from that, how that plays out. But, you know, if the United States is partly in and they're playing games the Myanmar people are going to get hurt because the Chinese are not playing games and they're not partly in, they're all in. As you say, they see this as their sphere of influence. So I think engaging diplomatically, engaging because we have relationships, because it's in our interests, engaging along with our partners and allies in the region in an open and in a constructive way so that the people, the Kachin people and KIA and others have get the rights and dignity that they deserve, as well as everybody else in that country. You do it that way, that would be, frankly, in more in America's long-term interest than playing some of these other short-term, quote, strategic games that, frankly, are not very smart and will lead us to a disaster.
Well, on your last interview with us, you had mentioned, you offered a suggestion of, at that time, a special envoy, and that Myanmar really does need a special envoy and someone that would be able to better understand and advise on the situation. And we have heard rumblings again. People have been trying to read the tea leaves. I want to return to that examination of that role of special envoy, if that's something you are still advocating as necessary with Myanmar's conflict and relations between the countries. And if so, what type of special envoy would be suited for that role, given the realities and practicalities of this administration?
That's the hard one. The realities of this administration is the hard part. And I had some hope early on in the administration that maybe you can get a special envoy and it could be just really... It's the administration talks about return on investment, efficiency, all that kind of thing. And if you put somebody out there, it reports directly to a few people at state, including Rubio, and just make it a few and very, very low key, or not low key, but not financially onerous, a few staffers, so that they at least are in the game. They're going around talking to our partners in the region. They're talking to the Kachin and the other forces, so that we're building those relationships and we're part of the conversation. Because right now we basically are nowhere to be found. We have people at the embassy inside the country, but they're hamstrung to do the type of work that needs to happen to try to bring together a consortium, perhaps to leverage a resolution over time that is in our respective interest. And that resolution does not have the junta at the core of it. It has the people at the core of it as being, from outside in, essentially. So I still think that would be ideal. I do believe a special representative of that type who understands the complexities and can deal with these complexities smartly and build these relationships that are important, not within the country, but also with our partners on the outside. Other countries in ASEAN, I think it would be very helpful. I don't know that this administration has anybody like that in mind. When they think of a special envoy, they may think of a business person, someone to work with the junta, or I don't know, to just be out there engaging. And that gets very dicey if they don't get the right individual with the right temperament and the right understanding. So yes, in generic terms, I'm in favor of it, but the right person is extremely important for a position like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Shifting now back to rare earth, which has been talked about a bit previous in this conversation, focusing a bit more on this topic of rare earth, it's you were thinking that this could be this is one way to get the Trump administration's attention. The economic interest. However, where do you go from there? Because on one hand, engaging on any level, even merely talking to the Kachin there, let alone, talking to the regime and the implications of that. This is, again, as we said, in China's sphere of influence. And then you have the issue of, where you can mine for rare earth, but then the processing becomes kind of an impossible thing to solve. And so, with all of those delicacies and sensitivities and really practical impossibilities, where does this leave how rare earth, which is something that Trump is very concerned about and something that, so much of the rare earth in the China processes comes from Myanmar, where does this leave possible lines of engagement with what could be done regarding rare earth and U.S. policy towards Myanmar?
Yeah. First of all, I'd say that China you know, asserts its sphere of influence. They think the whole country is its sphere of influence. They probably think the region is, as well as the border. And we should never do anything to suggest that we accept that. We should be engaging on a regular basis. That's why I talk about the envoy idea, on a regular basis with the Kachin and with the Shan, with others, everybody in the country, according to our interest and their interest, and let them tell us. You know, they can tell us how far is far enough or too far. They know their own interests. They know the balance of forces on the ground and the complexities, the political complexities that, that China creates and others create. And they can help us navigate what is the right balance there. And that means a bit of humility from a U.S. envoy, from U.S. diplomacy. But I think there's a lot more we can do to let them give us a sense of what the possible is. When it comes to rare earths specifically, it really is about investigating what practically can be done, as you say, given the processing capacity. You know, there's talk of India developing processing capacity over time. That will take time. What do you do meanwhile? The terrain in where this stuff is mined to get it out, they're just, the infrastructure doesn't really exist except probably to ferry it across the border east to China. So investigating it, having an honest, and I think we should do this anyway, just as part of our normal engagement to understand everything in the country. And if in the future something changes, we should know more about these mines, the infrastructure, what the rational, the reasonable infrastructure needs or possibilities are. In my sense is it just doesn't exist right now. It doesn't really make sense in a practical way, in a cost or in a structural way to do it. But we should investigate it. We should ask those questions. We should have those conversations. We should get, in which it sounds like they're maybe what Trump has asked for. And hopefully that report can get to the right people to make the right decisions.
You mentioned ASEAN a little bit ago, and previous administrations have looked at wanting to have better relations with ASEAN, to engage more, to see the Southeast Asian region as being really a very important part in the world of the population growth and the economic opportunities that are there, the famous pivot in the Obama administration at the time that you were appointed ambassador. And ASEAN was seen as a really potential critical part of this, of being able to engage them frequently and the right way and see their potential and impact of how that relation could grow. And so I'd like to prompt you to speak a bit about your thoughts on ASEAN, on the importance of that engagement, as well as how you're seeing their role actually playing out. I know it's a lot of us in the Myanmar space have some criticism, I'd say some justified criticism, of what more they could be doing.
I think our expectations should always be managed when we're dealing with ASEAN as a group. It is a group of 10, which makes it rather more unwieldy than it was when it was the original five. And they have a lot of different interests, and they have their own principles, internal principles, as they say, that mitigates a decisive impact. I do wish they can do more, but they have done, at least individual countries have done, some good in shutting down banking and other things. I think Malaysia and Indonesia have been trying to engage in a little bit more forward-leaning way. So I think it's good that they have isolated the regime and not legitimized it by bringing in members of the junta into the conversations, leaving empty chairs or having chairs filled by civil servants who are not connected to the junta. Those are all, they have to hold that line. Those are all very important signals to send that could be worse. I know it's somewhat of a low bar, but it definitely could be worse. I do think they can turn the screws a little bit more and demonstrate their dissatisfaction and recognize, and I think they do recognize, there may be individuals that I see who do writing who don't recognize that this is not simply a Myanmar issue. This is a regional issue. It crosses borders. It has impacts on others. And simply sitting back and assuming that you could watch it burn and pick up the pieces later, or get in bed with the junta because that's just the reality of the way Burma is and always will be, I think that's both morally and strategically bankrupt. And they need to recognize that sitting back and not doing more is actually doing harm to themselves. That if they were shutting down, if Thailand did more to really turn the screws, they would have less of a burden on their soil I use a new term, burden, advisedly. They have less of a responsibility for the movement of personnel, the humanitarian challenges that now the United States are exacerbating with a cutoff of funds for humanitarian aid. All this just creates a worse situation for the neighboring countries. And instead of sitting back and saying we really can't do more, they could turn the screws more and make it clear that this is impacting them directly and something has to change. And this is, again, where I see the United States and other partners, Japan, India, perhaps, and others, working with them potentially on a consolidated approach where we can tell, they can tell the regime, you know, if you think you can get away with an election, you can't. We're just not going to accept it. So that they realize, they don't feel they can take these steps to push the envelope or push things down the road. This needs to stop sooner rather than later. So I think, ASEAN is challenged that way, but I hope for more over time. They've eviscerated multilateral affairs at State Department. There is no Office of Multilateral Affairs anymore, which the folks who monitored South China Sea, who were doing ASEAN, this was just as Rubio was going to the ARF in Malaysia. So it, and then you remember, of course, that when he knows it now, but Secretary of Defense Hegseth, when asked at his hearing about ASEAN, knew nothing about ASEAN. He literally didn't know what ASEAN was, didn't know what the nations were. It's getting basically neglect, unfortunately. I don't know there's a lot of attention. It was good that Rubio went and showed up. I don't know that President Trump, I'm almost certain he won't go to some of these ASEAN meetings later in the year, it sounds like. That is a bad sign, a huge opening for China to reassert that you can't rely on the United States and that we are inevitable. We are here. You have to deal with us. The United States is imploding. And then Southeast Asian nations have, start to make choices. On the other hand, I think there's a low threshold because these nations need to have balancers. They need offshore balancing. They want bigger powers around. So I hope that this administration can come to a consolidated position on Southeast Asia and put people in place, but they don't exist. There's not a Southeast Asia person in the NSC now in the White House. Again, multilateral affairs is gone. A lot of the ambassadors aren't in place. So it's mostly neglect right now, which is really unfortunate after the main efforts that were made, great efforts by the Biden folks, though they, of course, were not perfect. And certainly Obama, when I was there, a lot of effort to engage Southeast Asia.
I think I hover personally from a place of wondering what's the worst of the two outcomes, neglect or engaging in the wrong way or, some sort of legitimization. And like, should I be leaning more towards hoping that this continues to stay off the radar completely and entirely? Or should I engage more towards hoping that there's some type of engagement and then knowing that it might not be great, but just hoping it's not going to be too harmful?
That's a very good point. And that's a reasonable point that you don't want to be in the crosshairs. You don't want to be in the line of sight of the White House too much. And so I think the balance there, that would be a nice medium where, yes, it doesn't really get a lot of attention from the White House, but there is a robust diplomatic corps. And we hope there'd be a USAID, which doesn't, or at least assistance efforts to give attention, necessary attention, and you mitigate the potential risks that come from being in the line of sight of this president. I think, again, I had heard earlier in the year, the second half of the year will be the Asia part. That was before the NSC was eviscerated. National Security Advisor was pushed out. The deputy was pushed out, both of whom were interested in China or more Asianists. The current NSC Asia lead is also in the line of sight of this MAGA influencer on the outside. So he's being very careful. I think Yeah, I don't know where I stand on the neglect versus attention side of things. I hope for a little more quality attention and more people that are focused on the issues of the region, given our really our serious interest in the region.
Yeah, I think the best case scenario that you indicated at the start of your answer of, you know, that it might not have direct attention at the top, but it has people in senior positions that know what they're doing and are trying to in their corner be able to engage in the right way. However, with the combination of the extent of the cuts that occurred and restructuring combined with some of the traditional values that we associate with American policy anywhere, democracy and human rights, and so many other things having been stripped away, it's hard to see where that best case scenario could come out and manifest. And, you know, on top of that, the president's predilection for strongmen, so-called strongmen, you know, and authoritarians, you know, and his discomfort with elections and election cycles, you know, it does leave open a kind of nightmare scenario of where engagement, looking at past examples of relations with other countries and other authoritarians of those countries, that, you know, that some type of engagement could be recognizing and meeting with the sorts of people that we really hope they're not going to be meeting with and recognizing.
Well, look, in Asia and in Southeast Asia, they, as you say, they have an affinity for strongmen. We're going to leave Myanmar out of it because that's a separate issue. And there's, you know, what's going on there. We need to be supporting the opposition to this coup. But there are other strongmen in the region that, you know, if the administration decides it wants to have a constructive relationship with somehow, it would be at the expense of human rights and of the people of the country. But again, it depends what interests. Maybe it will come at the benefit of economic interests or trade, or it gives countries options and better political diplomatic relations with some that we otherwise have had bad relations, like Cambodia, or you know, we've had good relations with Vietnam. But this is a balance, though, between you know, the economic interests and the whole trade thing, the tariffs, that a lot of the deals have been made with Southeast Asian countries, interestingly enough. So that's sort of out of the way. But it's still a point of friction in a region that values, needs markets and needs and values its exports. And American credibility has always been two-legged in Asia, to be honest. And it's less on the diplomatic, somewhere in the diplomatic, but it's mostly been because of these dynamics of strongmen, et cetera, has been trade and security. And on the trade side, we're creating a lot of friction, a lot of resentment. And they just don't know where we're headed. And we're just creating problems. We don't have to go down that rabbit hole of all the details. But then the second is the security. And that is moving forward. You know, the Pentagon is moving at pace with working with folks in the region, working to consolidate and to enhance our presence and our capabilities, and working with the Philippines, working with Australia, working with anyone, with Indonesia, others, you know, Australia with submarines and all. And that, I think, can be viewed as another balance. The question is, you know, does the economic come at the expense of people's sense of American reliability? Is the security enough when the economics, and that they're kind of working at competing tracks, just like we talked about Treasury working potentially at its own track. I don't know that all of this has been thought through as a singular strategy, but it needs to. Unfortunately, Trump really thinks of tariffs as somehow a complete separation from its own strategy, in essence, that's not connected to broader strategic, you know, diplomatic strategic interests. And that's the real wild card in all this. It could be positive that there are strongmen in terms of American engagement, if Trump likes strongmen for certain interests. It's certainly not good in the case of Myanmar, and not good for many of the people of the region.
Yeah, right. Now, looking at some of these other polarities, you've served across multiple administrations, and you've seen how U.S. policy towards Myanmar swings between what you've noted as idealism and disengagement. And so I want to prompt you with that dynamic of where you think we're at now, and in that balance, or if we've somehow, you know, transcended it, given the peculiarity of the current administration we find, and what you think is most understood in Washington about the stakes in Myanmar and the overall context?
Well, I mean, idealism. I don't see any idealism or any soft power recognition of even just taking it out of idealism, which sends a suggestion that it's somehow pie in the sky and a nice thing to have. It's just an ideal. There's very practical issues of soft power, whether it's in our humanitarian aid or in our Radio Free Asia and other things. It can attract people in the region to America. It may antagonize, of course, some of the strongmen in the region at the same time. So, but there's no idealism. It's very realist in the practical sense of power, economics, and trade, and what is in it for us. So the balance, there's not disengagement versus idealism. There can be engagement in a very non-idealistic way, a completely practical way that America traditionally, at least in the past century, has not been engaged. And it remains to be seen just how far that will be taken in this administration in Asia and in Southeast Asia in particular. The sense is that, forget about these issues of sanctions because of ideals. I think there is definitely a debate in the administration on that. They don't believe in Radio Free Asia. They don't believe in sanctions. They believe in just engage everybody. Whether that then gets applied to Myanmar is a major question. There'll be a lot of factors in Washington, including Congress, that'll be pulling against that, as well as some within the administration. But we'll see where that comes out. In terms of understanding the context and the importance of Myanmar, there's not a lot of knowledge in this administration of Myanmar at any level, even those who have an instinctive positive sense that we can't forget about it in a good way. We should always be thinking about how we can help the people of Myanmar. Even they don't understand much about the context and even necessarily the strategic value. Again, that's why people make the pitch of, hey, they have rare earths. Hey, they can be helpful with China. But then that gets some attention with these folks and potentially return on investment. These are the things they care about. But then you have to make sure they don't take it off too far in a way that is actually harmful to Myanmar and harmful to our interests. And that's the key balance that we have to maintain.
I don't know how many conversations I've had with people where they go that route. They go the route of rare earths or of hedging, being able to prevent and buffer further Chinese influence and say, oh, these are selling points and we can talk about this or that. And then the conversation goes and it's like, but I don't know if I actually, maybe that's not so good to bring that up, because then once they realize that, then there could be a way of engagement like this. And then you go back to that polarity of, is it better not to say anything or is it better to say something to a certain point? And what are the risks of, then presenting kind of this kind of treat in the distance, but then having a type of engagement that becomes really harmful. And, and then you have, you have China's role in this, which is, wanting, constantly talking about not wanting to interfere with internal affairs, and then being so engaged with Myanmar's internal affairs and telling others not to be, that it's this real contradictory mess of what it is they're doing and how they, as you said, how they see it and they want to claim it as their sphere of influence. And yet how, American engagement with that, traditionally the soft power ways of engaging was of supporting democracy and civil society and human rights and these values that at least used to align with American administrations. And then you have Radio Free Asia brought in there that, if there was an interest in wanting to do something to counter Chinese influences in Myanmar, Radio Free Asia, Voice of America, these were great ways to do that. And those have been stripped away. And so it's, you do have this, this way of engagement in Myanmar that I don't think is fully thought out. I think these are coming from, different, motivations. And yet, there's a lot that's been done that has only left a vacuum and really encouraged far greater Chinese influence in Myanmar. And so when you're looking to try to buffer it, to try to have a buffer on that, it's, you've already given them a much greater free rein than we've seen in many years.
Right. Well, look, when you have to make the case, a very nuanced case, that It's not a matter of democracy isn't somehow, it's just not just an idealistic thing that actually works for our interests. If the people have a voice, and if, you know, look, democracy is going to be tough to install regardless of what happens. I think I think the key is you make the point that this is not simply about the best way of getting at the China factor is building relations with those in the country to ensure that they have their rights respected. What we represent is sovereignty of the people. I think that generally this is the tenor of our foreign policy, or had been, certainly wasn't Biden, and there's some of that in this administration, that sovereignty of people, their ability to have a say, or we care about what they care about. And if we, and this is where the trend line is going, the trend is not towards the junta. So if you are investing in the junta, you are investing in a devalued asset. You have to make the case that actually that's not where the country is. The country is elsewhere. We need to build relations with them by helping them get what they want, that will implicitly help us with the China factor. They will implicitly want to be aligned with us, that the country ultimately is very wary of China. They don't want to be part of a Chinese sphere of influence. They don't like China. So we don't have to go in there and do something ham-handed with respect to being anti-China or countering China. We simply need to be with them and help them achieve the peace and the dignity that they deserve. And they will naturally be partners of ours. And that will, it's not about pulling them from China, because China will always have influence in Myanmar. The Kachin are always going to be living on that border, and that's going to be a hardship for them. So the key is not to make it more of a hardship for them, but create the space so that their dignity is respected, and at least the international community recognizes that our approach is about affirming peace and stability and dignity. And that's why they're attracted to us rather than what the Chinese represent, which is coercion, corruption, and spheres of influence. And that's the competition we need to be engaged in. And that, to make that case, that if you go in ham-handedly, that looks like you're really, really smart. We're going to create a Western front, and we're going to give them weapons. We're going to, you know, they're already on our side, the Kachin, and it just may create a bigger mess for us. And it's going to blow up in our face later on, because it will invite the Chinese to do some things that make it into proxy. But again, I would be listening to the Kachin. I would be listening to the people on the ground who understand this better than I do, better than any American can, who have their own interests at heart. But our fundamental policy should be, if we can do something in their interest to bring dignity to the people of this country, that will automatically serve the strategic interests of the United States over time. And that's the case you make. And then all the other options are actually counterproductive. So don't do them. And it will cost a lot. For this administration, you say it will cost a lot in attention, cost a lot in resources. You know, it's not worth it. Those are the types of arguments you have to make. And I've started to make them to a degree, but haven't had the full conversations. I don't really know where they stand in their deliberations. So.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join us on this important conversation and to be able to bring your past engagement and experience to bear and to bring to light to examine the current issues going on that as we'll all continue to look at and see how they develop. And I would invite you, as we close here, if there's a last reflection or thought or statement you'd like to share with our audience about this conversation or the wider implications or Myanmar in general, to please do so.
Yeah. Well, look, from the conversation, I think we all have more questions than answers about, even, you know, I think there are more questions than answers in this administration, the Trump administration. Just remember, there are voices on Capitol Hill and in Congress who are very strongly, you know, they're passing bills and they're strongly trying to keep American policy where it has always been, which is with the people of the country. You know, we must do no harm in what we do, and we must do more. And I feel very badly about so far what we've done on the humanitarian side. And I'm just hopeful that can get back on track, and we can be on the side of the right for the people of Myanmar. I think the main message here, key message here, is that, you know, don't fall for the junta's attempt to try to propagandize here and try to make it seem like the United States has you know, they're in some kind of pen pal relationship with the president. There was an exchange of letters, but that was, I think that was in a particular realm on the tariff side. There is obviously a discussion ongoing about what Myanmar policy ought to be. It's always healthy to have policy reviews. But I think it is very important for U.S. policy to understand the dangers and complexities here and look at all these angles, not think in short term, but longer term strategic value. And at the same time, for the people of Myanmar to continue to make its case and demonstrate, frankly, that which is a reality, that the junta is on the losing side and that the resistance is on the winning side. They have the wind at their backs, as difficult as the situation is for a final resolution in the country, that the future of the country is with that democratic so-called, you know, resistance. I guess that's my final message, is for folks in the country not to believe the rhetoric and believe there's something, a turning of the back. But the United States needs to be smarter, frankly, unengaging, and standing alongside where things are headed, where things are trending in the country, which is on the side of the people.
And just to follow up with that, we should mention that as clumsy as this regime has been at times, they've been surprisingly skillful historically at being able to craft certain messages and narratives that for those that are paying attention on and off and don't have such a grip on the situation are really have been effectively for decades knowing how to play the international community. And the narrative that's being told here, and then combined everything that we've already said, combined with one other piece of detail that the you know, that they're also using the so-called concern about earthquake aid as a way to lift sanctions, getting that argument as well. This is also a regime that has been so skilled at being able to, you know, let no crisis go to waste and profit off of their own natural disasters that have happened, that this is another case or another potential case of crafting this narrative out of disparate pieces of information to try to shift attention from just how much they're losing and how fast they're losing, and perhaps to prolong the inevitable. And you know, let's give it to them. They've been handed pieces that they are able to put together to form that narrative. But I think what you're saying is that we need to be, you know, bring that background and institutional history into what we're seeing now, and to be very wary of the story they're telling, because they are clearly losing. And that is the trajectory and the direction that this conflict is going towards.
Yeah, don't get too down, but vigilance is absolutely critical. This is not over. I can't say with absolute certainty there won't be a fresh Burma policy, a fresh look. So it means that, you know, making the case, continuing to be engaged with Americans, American diplomats, and being careful how the rhetoric goes, not jumping to conclusions too quickly, but keeping powder dry, being vigilant, watching the space. And those of us who can engage quietly as well to try to talk through why certain policies make sense and certain policies don't.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. Each episode we produce is offered freely and always will be. Our goal is to inform, engage, and inspire as many people as possible with stories and voices that matter. And thanks to your support, we've been able to reach tens of thousands of listeners across the globe. This is truly remarkable. But to sustain this momentum, we need your help. Even if just a small percentage of our listeners committed to a very modest monthly pledge, we would not only be able to sustain our momentum, but grow. Even better, you might consider becoming a member to deepen your engagement with this platform and thereby gain access to additional content and other exclusive benefits. So, if you found value in what we offer and want to help secure the future of this work, however you want to make that happen, please visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to make a pledge, or navigate to insightmyanmar.org/membership to look at our member options. With your help, we can keep this work alive and thriving.